So today I'm going to be talking to you about lupus, and myself and Dr. Susan Wallace over in the corner there, you could raise your hand, are the two major rheumatology attendings on the Jacoby faculty. We co-precept the lupus clinic, Susan runs the joint pain clinic, and I run the arthritis clinic, which is a general rheumatology clinic for the fellows. So both of us are available for you when you need us. So back to lupus. The subsets of lupus, as you know, include discoid lupus, drug-induced lupus, neonatal lupus, the antiphospholipid syndrome, and the systemic lupus, whether a benign or incomplete presentation. Subacute cutaneous lupus is a strictly dermatologic diagnosis, which typically patients are ANA negative, but will have a positive Rho or SSA antibody. And then there's the DNA-positive, complement-fixing, hypocomplementemic, and very active systemic lupus. Drug-induced lupus, these are some of the known agents that are associated with drug-induced lupus. Anywhere from hydralazine to INH has been associated. So lupus affects 500,000 to 1.5 million of United States population. The female-to-male ratio is 10 to 1. As far as childhood lupus, the ratio is more like 2 to 1, and it comes back to that after menopause, suggesting a hormonal influence. However, even though there are fewer males who have lupus, you should know we have about 5 males in our lupus clinic, so you may come across them because they actually have a more severe presentation. These are the patients who are in particularly more refractory to treatment. 70% of lupus patients are females between the ages of 15 and 45. The African-American to Caucasian ratio is 3 to 1, and it's the highest prevalence in Afro-Caribbean females, which is what makes the Bronx a great place to study and learn about lupus. There are various genetic factors associated with developing lupus, whether HLA associations or lack of manufacturing of complement proteins. There's also environmental factors. The concordance rate for monozygotic twins is 30%. A child of a lupus mother has a risk of 7% of developing lupus itself. And there is an ANA positivity of up to 20% in the population. So not every time that you see a patient who has a positive ANA, does that mean that they have disease? Most likely it doesn't, because lupus is really not that common. It's 10 times more likely to have a false positive. And also there's plenty of patients who have a positive ANA but have other diseases, which we'll talk about. This is what I was talking about. There are certain null alleles that cause deficiency of one of the early complement components, particularly C1q, C2, or C4, and these are thought to be strong risk factors for development of lupus. And many genes that have been associated with development of lupus are genes for other components of the immune system. So the etiology of the problems with SLE is associated with autoantibody production, leading to the generation of circulating immune complexes and episodic complement activation. And stressing the word episodic because, as you probably know, lupus is a disease of flares. So patients may have periods of disease activity where they're particularly sick. They may have low complements on their blood work. But then that's treated and they evolve into a period of disease inactivity. The pathobiology includes, as I said, autoantibody production, immune complexes, neutrophil and endothelial cell interaction with leukoaggregation, and thrombophilia is also a part of lupus. So these are some of the particular clinical effects associated with particular autoantibodies. So the anti-double-stranded DNA antibody, which is fairly specific for lupus, and seen in up to 80% of lupus patients, has been associated with kidney disease. The anti-Rho antibody, as I mentioned earlier, is associated with the skin disease. It's also associated with neonatal lupus and fetal heart problems. And as you know, the phospholipid antibodies, which we'll talk about later, are associated with thrombosis and pregnancy loss. So this is just to show you that there are certain particular associations with the antibodies. That's not to say that every patient who has a positive Rho antibody will have skin disease or have a fetal a fetus with heart problems, but these are the associated effects. So this is just, again, reviewing the serology. The double-stranded DNA specifically being associated with lupus, correlating with disease activity. That's one of the titers that we check when we're trying to assess for lupus disease, whether we're trying to see if a patient is coming in with some type of arthralgia and sort of weakness and fatigue, and we're trying to identify if it's a lupus flare or a viral syndrome. We will typically check the double-stranded DNA, and if that titer is rising, then we can most likely conclude that that's a lupus flare. The Smith is highly specific for lupus as well, but does not correlate with disease activity. So although in the Jacobi lab, when you order the ANA, when you type in ANA, it comes up as this full panel of serologies. It has the double-stranded DNA, the Smith, RNP, RO-LA, JO1, histone. Doesn't actually even have the nuclear ANA. We normally wouldn't send that entire profile at once. Every time you see a lupus patient, you don't need to check to see if their Smith has changed, but it's the double-stranded DNA that we really do look at, and the complements as well. So as I said before, the positive ANA can be misleading because it really is associated with a number of other conditions. Obviously, first and foremost, SLE, where up to 95% of patients will be ANA positive. But there is non-SLE connective tissue disease, which is associated with a positive ANA. Rheumatoid arthritis, Sjogren's, systemic sclerosis, CREST, myositis, those are also associated with having a positive ANA. So every ANA does not equal lupus. And as I mentioned, normal patients may be falsely positive. Other lymphoproliferative disorders are associated with the positive ANA, and chronic infections are associated with the positive ANA. Okay, so I wanted to review the classification criteria. So when you're seeing patients that you think may have lupus, as opposed to a known patient with lupus, you know which ones you should pay more attention to, which ones you should probably focus and try to work up for this disorder. And just to review, the first several features of the classification for criteria, the first four, are mucocutaneous manifestations, bless you, the malar rash, discoid rash, photosensitivity, and oral ulcers. But in addition to that, some other cutaneous manifestations are vasculitis and alopecia, which I'll go over. And just to note, alopecia is something that I think from early on everybody associates with lupus, whether patchy alopecia secondary to hair loss after a discoid lesion in the scalp or the frontal alopecia that lupus patients typically have. But that is not a part of the criteria. It's just an associated disease manifestation. So just to go through the criteria so you could see what it looks like, the malar rash, it's fixed erythema, flat or raised over the malar eminences and sparing of the nasolabial folds. Okay. The discoid rash. This is a pretty severe case of discoid. Most of the time it's more on the trunk and extremities with circular discoid lesions, but the difference from the malar rash is that it can be scarring and causes hypopigmentation or hyperpigmentation depending on the color of the original skin, and it's a little bit more difficult to treat. And this involves IgG deposition at the dermo-epidermal junction. Photosensitivity. This is where the patients get a skin rash as a result of a reaction to sunlight, whether the patient reports a history or if you see it directly. We will always tell our lupus patients, no matter what time of the year, what time of day they go outside, to be very cautious in the sunlight. We typically prescribe the SPF 70 Neutrogena just to protect them. We tell them, you know, wear protective clothing. Because even if they haven't had this reaction before, they can have it at any point in time. And you can see this person has it, you know, she was wearing, I guess, some type of V-neck T-shirt. Oral ulcers, these are typically painless. They may be oral or nasopharyngeal. And the classic way to try to assess whether a patient's telling you if their oral ulcer is a lupus manifestation or, you know, a canker sore or some other viral type of presentation is that they're typically painless, and the patients won't necessarily know that they've had it. So at every time we examine them, we have to look inside their oropharynx and their nasopharynx. This is just one of the other cutaneous manifestations of lupus. This is the subacute cutaneous lupus, which I told you about before, typically ANA negative with a positive rho. And you can see it sort of looks a little bit like a really bad case of psoriasis, although there's a little bit less of a white plaque, where there's scaling papules and plaques, and it's distributed in light exposed areas. And this is where there's a little bit of a central clearing with a scaling border. Cutaneous vasculitis associated with infarcts. This is one of the other cutaneous manifestations, alopecia. Okay, arthritis. This very specifically is a non-erosive arthritis, usually involving two or more joints, characterized by tenderness, swelling, or effusion. 80% of patients with lupus can have arthritis. If they're presenting with a flare, it would typically be a polyarticular flare. They have deformities, like in rheumatoid arthritis, but they're usually reducible, as opposed to the RA hands, which when they're deformed, you can't bend the fingers back into normal position. And this is the classic type of lupus arthritis, which is called Jacoud's arthritis, where they may have an ulnar deviation and looks like there's a couple of swan necks. But if you put your hands on the patient's hands, you can put them right back into normal position. And if you touch them, they will have swollen and tender joints, but they won't have the erosions or real joint space narrowing as seen in the rheumatoid patient. So if you have a patient that's presenting with arthritis, you know, a lot of the decision-making is whether it's rheumatoid or lupus, even if you have some positive labs from both cases. But if the patient's had long-standing arthritis and you have x-rays, if there's no x-ray findings, that's probably more likely lupus or an early RA presentation. But that's why we have to keep up with the x-rays, because if a patient year after year, their predominant symptom is arthritis, you have to make sure they don't have the erosions associated with RA. Sericitis is one of the other elements of lupus, where they may have pleuritis or pericarditis. And peritonitis is also associated with this. And this is very similar to the original case presentation, although that person had bilateral pleural effusions, pericarditis with a large heart here, and pneumonitis. So renal disorder, this is probably what you hear talk about most, the nephritis. Persistent proteinuria greater than half a gram a day, or CAS seen on the urinalysis, red cell hemoglobin granular CAS. There are seven elements of the classification criteria of lupus nephritis. This was recently reassessed, where one is mesangial, very minimal mesangial, and two is mesangial with increased involvement. Class three is the focal glomerulonephritis, where less than 50% of the glomeruli are affected and not an entire glomerulus is affected. I'll show you some pictures. Number four is underlined, because it's the type of nephritis that involves the most morbidity and is the most difficult to treat and requires the most aggressive treatment, the DPGN. Membranous nephritis is a more specifically associated with tons of proteinuria, heavy proteinuria, the nephrotic syndrome like you were mentioning before, as opposed to a lot of immune complex deposition. Class 6 is membranoproliferative, and class 7 is the advanced sclerosing glomerulonephritis, where they're really, their kidneys are very sclerosed. There's very little response to immune suppressive treatment because they're already at the chronic stage. This is to show you the different biopsies. Mesangial, where it's subepithelial deposits. The FGN, where you can see, this is really where there's, a lot of activity over here. However, this part of the glomerulus is relatively spared, as opposed to the DPGN, where you could see, for the most part, it's very hypercellular throughout the glomerulus. And this is the membranous, where you can see really a lot of sclerosis and the scarring. And this is the high amount of proteinuria classification. Okay, and this is the immunofluorescence staining, where you see a granular deposit of IgG in the glomerulus. So other features of lupus include neuropsychiatric lupus, where the neurologic disorder may be seizures or psychosis. And this is obviously seizures in absence of other incending causes, and psychosis in absence of other causes for acute delirium. Neuropsychiatric lupus is a very complex feature of the disease. As you can see, the list is very long, and we actually had our grand rounds last week from Betty Diamond, who was one of the previous chairs of rheumatology here, talking about neuropsychiatric lupus, trying to decipher, you know, the fact that it can be anywhere from depression to aseptic meningitis and chorea. So it's really a very broad category, and you have to obviously eliminate other possible etiologies, but it can be very widely spread. The SLE brain, this is one of the features of neuropsychiatric lupus, whether it's a cerebritis or an acute infarct related to phospholipid antibodies, just so you know. And this is showing leukoaggregation in a patient with known multiple cerebral infarcts. The hematologic manifestations include hemolytic anemia, leukopenia, lymphopenia is what we usually see, and thrombocytopenia, whether just associated with the SLE or in association with part of the antiphospholipid syndrome. And the serologies that are part of the criteria are the double-stranded DNA, the Smith, and also most recently added is positive finding of antiphospholipid antibodies, as well as a separate part of the criteria is an ANA. So if you have a patient who has an ANA, a Smith, or a DNA, and two of the other manifestations I mentioned in the criteria, you can say they definitely have lupus. If you have a patient who has a positive ANA and one of these other antibodies, and they just have a malar rash, you can say they probably do have lupus. You know, we tend to call that incomplete lupus, but keep in mind that the criteria for classification for all diseases are designed really for entrance into clinical trials. So you don't necessarily have to say, oh, this patient doesn't have exactly four criteria, so I cannot treat them for lupus and cannot work them up as having lupus. So if they look like they have lupus and they have some of the positive criteria, then you could probably start them on the pathway to treatment. You need 4 out of 11 criteria, as I mentioned. If you have that, you have a greater than 90% sensitivity and specificity for the disease. And this is basically what I was just talking about. So 90% of patients survive at 5 years, 80% at 10 years. The mortality is increased if it's renal disease. African Americans have a more aggressive and treatment-resistant course. Early on, the disease activity and infections are what are associated with mortality. And later on, disease activity and end-stage renal disease and atherosclerotic and thromboembolic disease are the greater sources of mortality in lupus patients. And that being said, the risk of coronary artery disease is 10 times greater in SLE patients, 50 times increased in SLE patients with age-matched normals in the 35 to 44-year-old age range. And this is a feature of the disease that most patients typically are not aware of. So along with all of their lupus care, we always have to do a lot of primary care, always have to make sure that, you know, their lipids are checked, that their blood pressure is appropriate. We always do screening for smoking, for other reasons that they may have coronary artery disease, and just always remind them that just by the mere fact that they have this ongoing inflammation in their body, like some of our other inflammatory diseases, that puts them at much higher risk for heart attacks. And when you put it into that language, they sort of hopefully will pay more attention. And some of the factors are not only the disease itself, but steroid therapy. Lupus patients tend to have hyperlipidemia and hypertension, and they also have the other associated potential risk factors.
I'm sorry, they have, what is the etiology for the heart attack, for the myosis? Atherosclerosis with strong bioinflammation from hypercholic state.
So there's a lot of research into this area, but lupus, RA, some of the other inflammatory arthropathies like psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis, just the mere fact of the ongoing inflammation puts their arteries at increased plaque building, and it's cytokine-based. And in addition to that, the lupus patients who have the antiphospholipid antibodies are also at higher risk of thrombus formation. So it's a bad combination. So antiphospholipid syndrome, this can be a disease unto itself, and when it's not associated with other inflammatory diseases, it's called primary antiphospholipid syndrome, and if it's a lupus patient who also has the antiphospholipid syndrome, it's called secondary APLS. It's not necessarily secondary to the lupus, but it's just sort of a part of that disease, where antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, as you know, it's vascular thrombosis, like we spoke about before, and or pregnancy morbidity, developing in persistently antibody-positive individuals. The most commonly used tests and the ones that we typically use here are the lupus anticoagulant and the cardiolipin antibody ELISA. And you can also do the anti-beta-2 glycoprotein 1 ELISA, which is the antigen to which these antibodies get bound. Antiphospholipid syndrome is present if more than one clinical and one laboratory criteria are met. So the clinical criteria are thrombosis, where there's one or more confirmed episodes of venous, arterial, or small vessel clot, confirmed by imaging or pathology, and without evidence of inflammation. And the pregnancy criteria, one or more unexplained deaths at more than 10 weeks, one or more episodes of preeclampsia or placental insufficiency at less than 34 weeks, three or more unexplained consecutive spontaneous abortions at less than 10 weeks, and obviously excluding other causes. The laboratory criteria are medium to high IgG or IgM anticardiolipin antibodies on two occasions at least 3 months apart, or the lupus anticoagulant, the same thing. So other associated findings with this disease are valve disease, livido reticularis, which is the lacy appearance to the extremities, thrombocytopenia, and nephropathy. And current recommendations for treatment of APLS, if the patient is, whether lupus or not, asymptomatic, antiphospholipid, antibody positive, has never had a clot, no history of pregnancy loss, typically no treatment is used. However, I have to tell you that a lot of these patients will be, like I said, at risk for coronary artery disease, have other factors, risk factors. So if they do have an antiphospholipid antibody, that might make you more inclined to put them on a baby aspirin. But the data is sort of plus minus for that. If they've had a history of venous thrombosis, they're placed on Coumadin or arterial thrombosis. And also if they have recurrent thrombosis, the Coumadin, the INR is the target higher level. And sometimes aspirin is also added. If they have the catastrophic antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, where three or more organ systems are involved at the same time, and it's a very rapid decline, the patients are treated with Coumadin, they're placed on steroids, and typically IVIG or plasmapheresis. Okay? That's something that you may see in the hospital. In pregnancy, aspirin 81 and prednisone are typically started along with heparin or low molecular weight heparin. And if there's a catastrophic event, like I said before, heparin, steroids, pheresis, IVIG, and sometimes Cytoxan. This is not for pregnancy. That's just for catastrophic APS. So back to systemic lupus. Some of the clinical features are all based on the criteria. There's constitutional features, cutaneous, joint, serosal, cytopenia, renal, neurologic, and the antiphospholipid syndrome. So how do you treat it? This is just a general list of treatments where, like I said before, we tell our patients to all use sunscreen. Topical steroids may be used for some of the rashes, NSAIDs for some of the mild articular complaints. Antimalarials is underlined because practically every lupus patient, unless they have a reason not to be, is placed on Plaquenil, not only for the cutaneous symptoms of the disease, but also we think that long-term it prevents flares, and it also may be associated with a reduction of events in the antiphospholipid antibody syndrome. That's some more recent research. Steroid treatment, cytotoxics, patients are typically put on calcium, their vitamin D is supplemented along with folate, and this is also to prevent the osteoporosis that we typically will induce with our steroid treatment, and they're given the appropriate vaccines. We want to avoid possible disease triggers for various reasons, and there's no real data to support it, but there tend to be an increased allergy to sulfa in lupus patients. So if you can avoid sulfa-based medications to do that, avoiding the sun, avoiding high estrogen, using other variables to prevent atherosclerosis, like I mentioned before, prevention of osteoporosis, clot prevention, treating infections promptly, and treating fatigue, making sure to rule out hypothyroidism, other metabolic disorders, myopathy. You know, every time a lupus patient comes to the emergency room, or is seen in the ER somewhere or gets admitted to the hospital, the tendency is to think that whatever is going on with them is related to their lupus. But it's not necessarily the only case. There's a lot of crossover in autoimmunity. In particular, hypothyroidism is seen in a lot of our diseases. So you always have to make sure that they're not also hypothyroid. And you always have to make sure that they're not having some type of overlap picture with one of the inflammatory myopathies. So these are things to look for when you're trying to figure out what's wrong with the patient. So steroid therapy is probably the most common answer that we'll give you when you call us for a consult as far as what to use when, whether it's a Wegener's or RA flare. But particular for lupus, we use steroid therapy in high doses when there's an acute crisis, whether it's an active nephritis, active CNS involvement, acute cytopenia, refractory sericitis, vasculitis. It says here severe constitutional. I probably would hesitate just giving somebody with fatigue high doses of steroids, but if it involves the other organ systems, then that's when you employ steroid therapy. And the cytotoxic therapies are a wide variety, and I just listed a few of them. One of them being azathioprine, which is also known as Imuran. It's a purine inhibitor. It's cytotoxic, decreasing cell proliferation. This is typically used for nephritis and of patients who have cytopenia. And keep in mind that these cytotoxic therapies are often added on. Let's say, we make an initial assessment that somebody has lupus. And if they're relatively not sick, we usually start them on Plaquenil, like I said, to prevent other organ manifestations or to treat a rash. And then as their disease evolves, if they have cytopenias or lymphopenia or arthritis, that's when we will add on the other medications. Methotrexate, which you probably know more about for rheumatoid arthritis, is often used when the lupus patient has articular manifestations because it's a good choice for that. Leflunomide is another medication more commonly used for RA, but can be used in lupus for the articular manifestations. MMF, which is also known as Celcept, it's a inhibitor of lymphocyte proliferation, mostly used for nephritis. And Cytoxan, as we mentioned before, can be used for very acute manifestations and also for treatment of nephritis, CNS events, immune cytopenias, and vasculitis. And we'll talk a little bit more about nephritis more specifically. For the constitutional symptoms, reassure them that even though they have a chronic disease, there's no cure, but there are treatments, etc. Rest, exercise, NSAIDs, the anti-malarials, steroids, tricyclics, and obviously referral to support groups. Every Monday we have Lupus Clinic in Building 8, and almost every week we have a woman who comes from the Lupus Foundation to speak with the patients, to give them informative information. This just sort of like, I think, introduces them to each other in an anonymous way. And these are things, there's a lot of lupus patients in our clinic who are less than 20 years old or who are, in that age range. And it's very difficult not only for them to really understand that their disease is lifelong, but as far as the compliance, that's the most difficult group. So if they, get to know other lupus patients in their age group, try to relate to someone else who has it, it's beneficial for sure. As far as treatment of the cutaneous manifestations, I mentioned already the Plaquenil and sun avoidance and sometimes steroids. Sometimes in those discoid lesions, the dermatologist will inject steroids right into the lesion itself, and that will help. But if they really have a diffuse rash, then you're not going to inject them in every point. If patients fail to respond to Plaquenil, the hydroxychloroquine, we may switch over to chloroquine. And if even further, if they fail, then we may use other immune suppressives like Dapsone, or this is when the Imuran sometimes gets into play when it's a really difficult rash to treat. And this is the person who had the malar rash you saw before. The articular manifestations, as I mentioned, methotrexate is commonly used. When patients come in with a flare from whatever manifestation, we tend to put them on short courses of steroid taper in order to quiet that flare, whether it's arthritis or one of the cytopenias. There's that same arthritis. Hematologic manifestations get treated with, you could see it's basically a repetitive list. It's just that, when the person gets sicker or when they fail to respond to the initial treatment, that's when you have to bring out the big guns, like the Cytoxan, IVIG, plasmapheresis. And these are probably the patients that you're going to be seeing more, because our patients that do well with plaquenil and Imuran and a little bit of steroid don't get admitted to the hospital. But it's the ones that come in infected or have a pneumonia or may have a pleural effusion that when you do their labs, you find that they're pancytopenic and their complements are to the floor. That's when you call us, and together we treat them with, you know, high doses of steroids and pulses and Cytoxan, IVIG, plasmapheresis. Rituxan is another medication that we use. In this case, it's a medication that you probably know more about associated with treatment for lymphomas, but we're using it now for our diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, some of the vasculopathies, and in particular lupus. Whether it's a lupus who has the hematologic manifestation, it's also being tested for nephritis as well. Sericitis, very similar. Always, you know, like I said before, don't assume that the pleural effusion or pericardial effusion is just their lupus, because these patients are on immune suppressives and they can get infected. So no matter what, you know, tap early, tap often, wherever there's fluid that shouldn't be, whether it's in the belly or in the lung or in the heart. Obviously, the heart a little bit more difficult, but in particular, if there's tamponade, you want to get that fluid out and make sure it's not infected before you start treating them with high doses of immune suppressives. Vasculitis is very similar to the other things. So nephritis, this is something that comes up a lot in the hospital, whether it's a patient who is a new diagnosis where you see a urinalysis with tons of protein and blood and lots of cells, and they have some positive antibodies, but they don't quite look like lupus, and we have to decide whether or not to do a biopsy. You know, I will always encourage the biopsy, and not that you can't start treatment within a few days, but I think it's always best to know what you're dealing with from the beginning, especially if the patient doesn't respond to treatment. And the goals of treatment for nephritis are to induce remission with a stringent immunosuppressive treatment, whether it's a combination of high-dose steroids and Cytoxan or high-dose steroids and one of our other cytotoxic drugs for a short period of time. The next part of the goal is to achieve response, and the last part is to maintain response in the long term. And that usually is, you know, this is the typical treatment of any itis, whether vasculitis, nephritis, what have you, you know, inducing remission, maintaining a response to treatment, and then the maintenance phase with a lesser immunosuppressive drug. And that's because it has to go on for a long term. Definition of response in nephritis can be anywhere from fair to complete, fair clinical response, about 0.5% of reduction of proteinuria and stabilization of the renal function. And I can tell you that early on in their nephritis course, you know, most patients with lupus who have the positive urinalysis and the DPGN, they will have a normal creatinine early on. It's only when they start to fail and don't respond to treatment that their creatinine also rises. So there's fair clinical response and complete remission. And only about a fifth of lupus patients will experience complete remission in 6 months. So that's just to sort of tell you how difficult it can be to treat. And this long list is really to show you that at the time that this slide was first put together, the management of lupus nephritis had a lot of possible options going on. The original treatment modality was an NIH protocol, which involved the Cytoxan, which is cyclophosphamide, given once a month for 6 months, and then once every 3 months for a total of 12 IV doses. So patients either got admitted or went to the chemo unit and had a, you know, the IV. And that medication, obviously, it's an immune suppressant. It has a risk of sterility. So people were and are constantly trying to find other drugs that are equivalent to that for induction. So now a lot of people are using this MMF, which is Cellcept, also to try to achieve the induction phase, to try to get past that initial very high nephritic range protein. And then eventually leading over to the maintenance phase, whether they use Cytoxan or the Cellcept at the beginning, switching over to a less immune suppressive medication, whether it's Cellcept or Imuran. And there's tons of trials ongoing for trying to get, you know, deciding which is better, which is worse. We sort of tailor it to what the biopsy showed, how much activity, how sick the patients are. The sicker patients and the people who have already had children are the ones that we try to give Cytoxan to, usually, if their other organ systems are involved in particular. But a patient who has you know, a focal proliferative nephritis with not a lot of chronicity and a little bit of activity, we may try to give just an oral regimen rather than expose them to the potentially sterility-inducing medications. And obviously, concurrent with those treatments, we try to keep the proteinuria down with ACE inhibitors or ARBs and low-protein diet. Treatment for the nervous system manifestations is the same as the others, especially if the patients are hospitalized and they have an acute cerebritis or acute onset of seizure activity thought to be related to lupus. And there's, like I said, you know, lupus is the focus of a ton of research. We have a very productive laboratory on the ACOM campus researching lupus nephritis. We do a lot of mass research in that area looking for different disease markers, markers of disease activity other than the double-stranded DNA antibody to try to identify patients early on in the time of a flare. And there's a ton of ongoing trials that we participate in and that are ongoing across the country and throughout the world trying to look at this new immunoablative therapy, whether it's with stem cell transplant, B-cell modification, like I told you before, rituximab is already being used, and all of these different modalities to try to sort of target the disease at its various points in the pathway. So some of the pitfalls with respect to lupus are, like I mentioned, these ANA-positive patients who don't have lupus but who actually have fibromyalgia. You know, it's very, very difficult to distinguish sometimes because the patients really will tell you, the fibromyalgia patients really believe that they have swollen joints. But if even if they have a positive ANA, if they don't have any other features of disease, they don't have the disease. Some other problems with lupus are the use of steroids. You know, some patients get put on steroids and they have to be placed on steroids for long periods of time. That leads to obvious other manifestations and other complications. Poor compliance is, like I mentioned, not only in the younger patients, but for whatever reason, there tends to be, you know, and I've worked in several different lupus clinics, there tends to be an issue of compliance in this population, and I don't know if it's because of just the fact that they're younger, or, you know, maybe there's a component of the neuropsychiatric lupus and anxiety and depression related to the disease. So what is your role? So what do you do when you think you have a patient who has SLE? The initial laboratory are CBC, SMA, the key serologies being the ANA, double-stranded DNA complements, SED rate, CRP, your analysis, rheumatoid factor as well, checking their vitamin D. Also, if you think they may have an overlap with whether it's scleroderma or myositis, order the appropriate labs. If there's any significant arthritis, like I mentioned before, you really should check x-rays to make sure it's not an erosive arthritis. And if the patient has a previous diagnosis of SLE and now they're coming in for care, really want to reassess them, checking to see which serologies are positive, whether they have positive antiphospholipid antibodies. When should you refer patients to rheumatology to confirm the diagnosis, to assess disease activity and severity, managing uncontrolled disease? Like I said, we have a lupus clinic, so if you're following lupus patients for other organ systems or other long-term medical problems, make sure they're also seeing us. And if they have a cutaneous version of lupus, they should be seeing the dermatologist. The follow-up, typically we see patients with lupus if they're very active. We see them every 4 weeks, sometimes every 2 weeks, until their disease quiets. But usually it's more of a 3 or 4 month follow-up. Every time they come in, we do the routine labs. We do the urinalysis to make sure they're not developing something new. Just because a lupus patient didn't present with nephritis, that does not mean in any way that they won't eventually develop it, even if they're on medication, unfortunately. So some of the severe life-threatening complications, as you probably already would imagine, cardiac, hematologic, neurologic, myopathies, the pulmonary hemorrhage, pulmonary hypertension. They can have a mesenteric vasculitis. They can have a pancreatitis related to this disease, and obviously renal and skin manifestations. The side effects of the medications could be another lecture entirely. But for the most part, all these patients, you know, obviously the glucocorticoids have the side effects that you know, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, osteoporosis. They have to be monitored for those types of things with bone density. The patients on the cytotoxic need to have the CBC. They usually have an SMA. I mean, these are the things that we keep up with very frequently for our patients. Patients on chronic steroid therapy should also be on calcium and vitamin D. They may also need bisphosphonate. Okay, so this is just the role of the primary care physician in the clinic. Patients have more frequent access to their primary care physician as opposed to the specialty services. So really what you need to know is when the patients are getting sicker. And if you're seeing a patient that you think may have lupus and you want to either start treatment or want to make a diagnosis, you should always feel free to call us, page the fellow on call, even if it's not lupus. Obviously, if it's something else that you think is related to one of our diseases and you want to refer the patient, if you think they're sick and they need to get seen soon, and especially if you want to know what to order in advance of the patient showing up to us, because it's always easier if they already have the labs and the x-rays before they get to us. Otherwise, their initial visit basically is a two-part visit. So just always call either myself or Dr. Wallace or the fellow on call. And so I just wanted to finish with a case report and ask any questions, by the way, now, or I should have mentioned that before or at the end. This was a 19-year-old Hispanic female with no past medical history who presented with 3 weeks of intermittent fevers, T-max almost 104. She had weakness, retrosternal discomfort, and proximal muscle weakness. Denied weight loss, chills, headache, chest pain, shortness of breath, or GI or GU symptoms. What do you think is on this list for the differential? So I would say myositis. I would say viral illness, like EBV. I didn't hear you. What? Oh, okay. Same thing. All right. Okay, her initial physical exam, she was tachycardic and slightly tachypneic, normal SAT. On the physical exam, she had trace alopecia, and upper and lower extremity strength was 2 out of 5. Initial labs, pancytopenia, SMA10 within normal limits. She had elevated liver enzymes, bilies were normal, albumin was low at 2.3. Her urinalysis showed 3-plus protein in blood. Her EKG was normal except for the tachycardia, and the x-ray was normal. CK was elevated at almost 4,000, LDH 1,200, and there was a small pericardial effusion on echo. This was the first patient I saw as a first-year fellow in Bellevue, and it was insane. So the other data were that she had an ANA of 1 to 1280, positive double-stranded DNA, C328, which is very low, C46, and also positive Smith and RNP antibodies. So this is an example of a patient with a clinical picture and lab data consistent with an acute presentation of SLE with acute cytopenia, myositis, sericitis, and nephritis. So there you have almost all of the classification criteria in one patient. For the most part, this is not the way lupus patients present. They usually present with some, you know, fatigue, arthritis, and maybe a rash. But, you know, these are the patients that will come through the emergency room that I think you'll probably see before we see them. So I just wanted to present this case. Okay, thank you very much for your attention. Does anyone have any questions?
You just mentioned ACE inhibitors for lupus nephritis. Do you use them for every case of lupus nephritis, or do you use them only for lupus nephritis with nephrotic syndrome?
Well, by definition, lupus nephritis is proteinuria and an active urine sediment. So obviously, if the patient has low blood pressure, I won't use it. But I typically do use it for every patient who has lupus nephritis. Whether it's a low dose or not, we typically use it until we can't, to try to reduce the proteinuria in general. Any other questions? So like I said, myself and Dr. Wallace, who had to go to the lupus clinic, we're here. Our office is just down the hall from here. If you're ever interested in coming to clinic or being on the elective, just send me an email. I'm the fellowship director now, the associate fellowship director, so if you have questions about rheumatology fellowship, let me know, and we're always here. If you have questions about your patients, please do not hesitate to page. Our fellows are on call all the time, and you can also always call or email me. Okay, especially if there is a lupus patient in the hospital, whether you think it's something that you need us or not, just let us know, because we take care of all the patients. Okay? All right, thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks.